This year, a very important public figure turns 80. He sent us his wish for his birthday.
My wish is for everyone to practice wildfire safety, because only you can prevent wildfires.
That sounds easy enough. Bet you don't know who it is. Nah, of course you do. It's Smokey Bear. Let's all make sure Smokey's wish comes true by learning his wildfire prevention tips at SmokeyBear.com. Because Smokey Bear lives within us all. Brought to you by the USDA Forest Service, your state forester, and the Ad Council.
I'm Michelle Goldberg.
I'm Ross Douthat.
I'm David Leonhardt. And this is The Argument. This week, we're taking a look at abortion laws around the country.
There is this sort of zone of abortions that the pro-choice side is defending that most Americans in the middle don't support.
Then, Medicare for all. Could it ever actually work?
We're the wealthiest country in the world. There is a way.
And finally, a recommendation.
I just need to say that Ross is younger than me.
Last week, a video from the Virginia State House created a political firestorm. It showed a Democratic legislator, Kathy Tran, making the case for a bill that would remove some abortion restrictions. Among other things, third trimester abortions would be available even if a woman's health were not at risk. The response from pro-life advocates was swift.
The move sparking outcry all across the country, with many Americans asking, how is this okay?
They said that the video was proof that Democrats supported live birth abortions. The pro-choice side called this charge false, and a national debate ensued. In the State of the Union address, President Trump made sure to mention abortion.
I am asking Congress to pass legislation to prohibit the late-term abortion of children.
Since we started this podcast, we have heard from listeners asking us to have a conversation about abortion. It is a subject that both Michelle and Ross write about regularly from very different perspectives. And today is the day that we're going to get into it. Michelle, why don't we start with you? Can you break down for us what exactly the bill proposes?
So first you have Kathy Tran, the delegate who introduced this legislation. It's been introduced in many, many past legislative sessions, would basically take away some of the restrictions on third trimester abortion in Virginia.
In existing law, it needs to be three doctors and they need to testify that it would deeply harm the health of the
right.
mother.
So in existing law, they need to say that it would substantially impair the mental or physical health of the woman. So Kathy Tran is testifying, and she's presented with this hypothetical that is really both ridiculous and kind of insulting, right?
Like, by a Republican legislature.
By a Republican, right? Like, what if the woman is dilating, she's about to deliver a baby, and she gets a certification that she could have an abortion? Could she do it under your bill?
Mr. Chairman, that would be a decision that the doctor, the physician, and the woman would make.
I understand
that.
I'm asking if your bill allows that.
My bill would allow that, yes.
You know, she should have said, like, hypothetically, yes, but that will never happen. Instead, she just said, yes, that would be allowed. So this goes viral. Pro-choice radicals want abortion on the delivery table. And then Ralph Northam is on the radio. And
the Virginia governor,
right, the Virginia
as we
governor,
now all know.
Right, so the Virginia governor, who in addition to being an egregious racist, is also a pediatric neurologist. So he's asked about this. And he basically says that he, I think, is, and this seems to me the most logical explanation for what he's talking about. He's basically saying, in a situation in which the pregnancy is failing, right, in a situation in which you have this fetus that, is not going to survive and you're on the delivery table, the sort of in the situation, in the hypothetical that this Republican lawmaker has presented, here's what would actually happen. The woman would deliver the baby, it would be resuscitated, and then the parents would make a decision. But conservatives heard that and they thought, oh my God, they're trying to pass a law that you could basically change your mind about having a baby while you're in the middle of labor and then have it killed afterwards. You know, Marco Rubio's tweeting about it. Now Ben Sasse wants some sort of resolution to prohibit this thing that doesn't happen, which is this sort of like, you know, kind of legislation as propaganda. Because, you know, if you're kind of banning something, you're basically admitting that you think it's a thing in the first place. But it has now reignited this debate about third-term abortion.
And so just before we get to Ross, you are in favor of this legislation because you feel like, look, this will apply to a tiny number of cases, but they are heartbreaking cases where it is extremely difficult circumstances, babies are dying, and we don't want to put bureaucratic hurdles, legal hurdles in front of mothers in these situations.
So to be super clear, we actually don't know, and there actually isn't good data about all of the reasons that women seek third trimester abortions. I mean, we do know that one reason that women seek third trimester abortions is essentially a form of miscarriage management, right? When the pregnancy is sort of failing over time, and there's actually in some places nothing in the law that allows the medical system to deal with women in that circumstances, right? So women have to carry failing pregnancies for weeks or, you know, are forced to kind of go through stillbirths when they would have preferred to terminate 2 months earlier. I think there probably are cases that are going to be allowed under this law that I would probably consider morally abhorrent. But to me, the greater danger and what the reform is designed to do, and let's be clear, this reform isn't happening, right? This is something that was proposed by a delegate that never had any chance of passing, even though we're all talking about it and it's now become a subject of national controversy. You know, I had a really close relationship with my OB, right? I can't imagine in that situation then having to get permission from two other doctors to do what we decided was best.
Ross, I know you think of this bill very differently, both in terms of what it would do, but also in terms of how important it is, because as you've pointed out, in New York State, for example, they actually have passed a version of this law. So take us through your thoughts on this law.
So I guess it's useful to think of this in terms of sort of two sets of cases that the anti-abortion side, my side of the argument, is thinking about when we argue about this bill and when we talk about a viral video clip like this one, right? So the first is a set of cases that do relate specifically to what happens to infants, former fetuses, turned babies that are either born alive in the course of a late-term abortion or in some potential world are born alive with a terrible medical condition, a serious disability, and so on. And that's a very, very small number of cases, especially in the first case, but they do in fact exist, right? And there's a lot of legal uncertainty about what happens in those cases, what is allowed in those cases, whether there is a legal right to life for that being, that creature. At the same time, the other thing that the pro-life side is trying to highlight in these arguments is the argument against abortion at 39 weeks extends perfectly reasonably back to abortion at 32 weeks and abortion at 27 weeks and so on. There are very, very few abortions in the United States that take place at 36 or 37 weeks. There are a lot of abortions in the U.S. that take place on basically the line between the second and third trimesters of pregnancy. There are various estimates, but
And that's what week?
That would be 22 to 26 or 27 weeks, right? And so the reason these bills then become a flashpoint is both about the possibility of infants being killed outside the mother's womb, which is rare but real, and also the fact that there's just a larger argument here, right, where what is at stake is the question of whether a fetus is human and what kind of rights it has. And talking about the reality that, you know, you have this moment where legally something ceases to be a fetus and becomes a baby by passing out of the mother, that's a way of highlighting the fact that in terms of its own being, its own ontology, if you will, it doesn't change at that moment. And any changes further back through pregnancy are incredibly gradual changes. And if you are as this a person in the mushy middle, and we can, you know, We can use you as our person in the mushy middle. If you are appalled by the admittedly extreme possibility of an unborn baby being aborted at 39 weeks, you might be appalled by the same thing happening at 26 weeks. And then we've tugged you a little bit towards what I think is the correct take, which is that abortion is too abhorrent to be, in most cases, legally permitted.
First of all, I can't speak for the whole pro-choice movement, but my own sense is that when you were talking before about the reluctance of people on the pro-choice side to extend protections to babies that are born after a botched abortion, it is not because they're afraid that extending, or at least for personally, it's not that I'm afraid that extending legal rights to a baby would then sort of raise the question of, like, why those same set of legal rights shouldn't have adhered, you know, 15 minutes earlier. It's that there's a law against infanticide, right? And so from my point of view, what I see these laws is trying to do, again, I see them as sort of legal propaganda, trying to instantiate in the law prohibitions on something that it has not been made clear to me either happens, and if it does happen, is not already illegal. But the thing I appreciate the most about what Russ says is that he kind of admits what people on the pro-choice side know, which is that the point of these laws are to be the sort of thin edge of the wedge in a broader quest to make all abortion illegal.
Sure. And similarly, I appreciate Michelle conceding that inherent in the pro-choice position is the tolerance of something that, in your own language, are morally abhorrent in order to protect the greater good of women's rights and so on. Right. So I think we've both sort of admitted something, not against interest, because I think it's important to understand this debate. Right. I mean, the pro-life side is in this interesting position in this country where there is a set of abortions that are largely legal in America, but generally legal under Supreme Court jurisprudence, that would not be legal in other countries and that are extremely unpopular, right? If you poll abortion after 20 weeks, if you poll third trimester abortion, it's a 60-40, 70-30, 80-20 kind of issue against the pro-choice side. This is a political advantage, even though, again, from the pro-life side, it's also a great human tragedy, right? That there is this sort of zone of abortions that the pro-choice side is defending that most Americans in the middle don't support. And the offer that the pro-choice side makes to you, David, is basically to say, you know, we understand that you don't agree with us that first and second trimester abortion should be illegal. But if you agree with us on this much, it's a reasonable move for you to make, and you will still have the option not to listen to us about the other two trimesters. So won't you come along with us this far? While Michelle is saying, but look, they're admitting that they want to go further. And the reality is that we do, right? It's not the case that pro-lifers are just being dishonest. Like, even from a pro-life premise, there is a particular horror to third trimester abortions, right? The pro-life view would be, look, abortion is always a form of murder, but there are various forms of murder, and murdering a more conscious, more sentient form of human life is worse than doing it in the first trimester. So there's a consistent pro-life case for thinking all abortion should be outlawed, but third trimester abortions especially. But with that being said, again, allowing for the real complexities of human life and the necessity of certain legal exceptions, they all should be outlawed.
So people will point out that, you know, in European countries, abortion is typically tightly regulated after, I don't even know.
Either 12 or 20 weeks, basically.
So, and I think that, you know, pro-choice people, I think most of us would like say, well, if that's the compromise, we'll take it, right? We would happily trade a situation in which abortion is free, widely available, and uncontested in the first trimester in exchange for these sorts of restrictions. The reason that we're not willing to sign on to these sorts of restrictions is because there's a reason why people end up waiting too long, and there's a reason why people end up with money troubles. And it's because a restrictive series of abortion laws ends up pushing women into the second trimester, right? And so there's something sort of perverse about saying, from the pro-choice perspective, saying, well, you know, in Europe, they're willing to draw this line. Why aren't we willing to draw this line? I think pro-choice people, the vast majority of us, even the sort of like most hardcore, would be more than willing to make a European style compromise. But that depends on a level of social trust that these restrictions aren't just sort of Trojan horses that are meant to take away women's access to abortion altogether.
I mean, the way I read the polls, there are three groups of Americans. I think they're broadly similar in size, but maybe one group is closer to 25% and one closer to 40%. A group of Americans who basically do not want abortion in almost any circumstances to be legal. On the other side, a group of Americans who want abortion to be legal in almost all circumstances. And then a group in the middle who, depending how you ask the questions, will answer it in different ways, but basically are in favor of abortion being legal in some circumstances, but are also in favor of some restrictions, right? And so
what, and those numbers just to jump in, have been remarkably steady.
Remarkably
over
steady.
The last 40 or 50 years.
And I certainly find myself, one, agonizing over this issue, and two, in that middle group. I would always, if forced to choose a label, I would always choose pro-choice. But I find this issue, unlike many other issues, to be an unavoidable clash of rights. The rights of the mother and the rights of the fetus or the baby, right? With gay marriage, I see no clash of rights. Mm-hmm. With voting, I see no clash of rights. With this issue, I see this unavoidable clash of rights, often a heartbreaking clash of rights. And on the one hand, I do think many of the examples that are brought up by the pro-life side are these rarer than rare examples that do not describe the experiences of most American women, anywhere near most. But on the other side, I think there really are some really tricky things about the idea of unregulated abortion in this country.
Well,
right?
We don't have unregulated abortion in this country.
If we were to get there. In many states, we have extremely regulated abortion, more regulated than I would like.
But I mean, I think we should push a little bit on this question of sort of compromises, right? Because I think, you know, again, the pro-life side looks at places where the pro-choice side is in power, right? Where political liberalism is in power, be it Scandinavia or New York State. And it doesn't see what you're describing, Michelle. It doesn't see a world where the pro-choice side is willing and eager to have third trimester restrictions so long as abortion is readily available in the first two trimesters. In fact, it sees situations where you have permissive laws and high abortion rates, right? Well, I think there's a conceit that the pro-choice side has that you can make all good things go together, that you can pro-life laws just sort of create more abortions in the end, or women wait too long and so on. And the reality is, if you go state by state in the U.S., the highest abortion rates are in the places with the most permissive laws. It's about what you would expect. And there isn't a world where the pro-choice side takes power and suddenly they're willing to compromise in ways that impose any restrictions at all.
Well, right. But think about why New York passed the law that it just passed and why there was so much celebration, right? It was very specifically in reaction to Brett Kavanaugh and the Supreme Court and the sense that the Supreme Court is going to take Roe versus Wade away from us. Let's codify all the rights that we can. And so, like I said, because people on the pro-choice side don't believe that there even is a good faith argument being made against these late term abortions, I mean, it is.
But do you think there isn't a good faith argument being made? Do you think pro-lifers don't think that late term abortions are worse than first trimester abortions?
I do find it hard to believe that some people on the pro-life side who in no other circumstances evince any concern for the weak or vulnerable, I do find their passion on this issue suspicious.
Okay.
Right?
Can I
just say one quick
yes?
thing? I mean, the fact that you could not even get pro-life people to be outraged about the water crisis in Flint, which was causing an epidemic of miscarriages, right? So you have this case where kind of the government is causing mass fetal death, and you see sort of no solidarity from the anti-abortion movement. It does make me fundamentally question their good faith concerns. Not all of them, but certainly some of them.
Okay, you know? but there we're also dealing with the difference between the pro-life movement as sort of an institutional force within partisan politics in the U.S. and the pro-life movement as consisting of the much smaller number of Americans who are zealous about the issue. And there, you know, look, I belong to the Roman Catholic Church, right? The Roman Catholic Church has condemned Donald Trump's border policies. It has taken what amount to left-wing positions on just about every issue related to healthcare and the environment for 30 or 35 years. It's a pretty big, important institution, maybe less important than it used to be. But when I go to church and when I read the documents put out by my bishop's conference, I don't see an unconcern for human life.
No, I think that's true.
The womb,
I think that
right?
I think the Catholic Church, you're right, and the Catholic Church just, you know, particularly people within the Catholic Church who have the consistent life ethic and who are also opposed to the death penalty. I mean, you're right.
Ross, there are a substantial number of people who identify themselves as pro-life, who when faced in their own lives or the lives of someone in their family with an unintended pregnancy, change their view when it comes to themselves. They basically say, wait a second, the idea of forcing a woman, whether it's the person themselves, because men and women have remarkably similar views on abortion, whether it's the person herself or whether it is someone's sister or wife, these are people who identify as pro-life, but when faced with the actual situation of unintended pregnancy, basically don't want to force the woman to carry that baby all the way to term. We're here talking early in pregnancies. How should we think about how frequent that flip of principle to personal experience is? Because that, to me, is a pretty strong argument in favor of abortion rights, at least early in pregnancies.
I mean, I'll be honest. I don't think I've ever known someone who was pro-life in a sincere way who made that kind of flip. I think you get that kind of flip if your pro-life sentiment is extremely casual and, you know, it's like, well, you grew up in Red America and you're vaguely pro-life and then you're confronted with reality and you flip and so on. But I mean, the reality is that, like, look, you know, legal abortion, like, this is, again, sort of a difference in just sort of construction of how we understand legal regimes, right? But legal abortion creates its own incentives, right? If you have legal abortion, it's there as a possibility, and that inevitably changes how you think about it and changes how people, their sort of decision-making structure, I think.
So, Michelle, my question for you, it's not about these edge cases, mm-hmm. right, which I agree with you often feel hypothetical and ludicrous. For me, the most agonizing part of this it's around technology and it's around something that to me starts to get close to eugenics, right? It's around the idea that we increasingly have tests that say, does this human being have Down syndrome? Does it look like it's going to be the perfect specimen? And I am really uncomfortable with a world where we essentially make it possible to test for the perfection of a fetus and then decide whether that fetus is going to be allowed to live to term. I don't pretend to know how to construct laws around that, but it makes me deeply uncomfortable with the full notion of unrestricted abortion rights.
Yeah, no, of course. I mean, and, you know, obviously that stuff makes me uncomfortable too. I think to me the most obvious example and something I've written about is sex selective abortion in, you know, in Asia, but in other places too, right? Where
yes.
you have, you know, basically huge gender imbalances because women, you know, pay real prices often for giving birth to a daughter, or there's real, there's real sort of material reasons why people feel like having a daughter is going to put them at a huge disadvantage. And so you have a lot of sex selective abortion. In some cases, it has replaced a tradition of female infanticide. So in that case, it's a slightly more humane alternative, but it's still a real problem. It's an expression of misogyny. So the question then, particularly in the American context, is that something that you can regulate away through the law without sort of infringing on women's rights to make their own decisions? Because we don't have reason-based restrictions in this country. And so, you know, and this in some ways is a very conservative position to say that I think that you can find a cultural development really morally troubling without necessarily thinking that there's a legal solution to it, right? That the solution is actually cultural. And then in as much as there is a sort of policy solution, I would say it's to make the cost of caring for children with disabilities less crushing for parents who want to do it. The reason that most people who are pregnant with a fetus that has Down syndrome have abortions are not cavalier. And so I think that we should have and this might be a bit of a cop-out, but we should have the robust social supports and welfare state that would allow people who want to raise a child with Down syndrome to do so without feeling like they were endangering, you know, the future of their children, without feeling as if it was going to, you know, without feeling as if they were basically consigning themselves to life of penury.
I would just say there's a style of pro-life argument that relies on the possibility or the reality that women are having abortions for cavalier reasons. I think the more compelling argument around this issue is that what Down syndrome does in an extreme way, every child, every birth, every kid you have does in a profound way. It's to have a child is to accept a totalizing burden for decades, for basically the rest of your entire life. And in that sense, what the pro-life argument is saying is that, you know, this is not something, though, that is just that sort of imposed on us. This is the nature of the human condition. And we need all of those supports, right? I think it's, you know, the weakness of the Republican Party is that it isn't offering enough support for the women who it wants to have babies. But the answer is to care and not to kill.
I actually want to end by saying thank you to both of you, because as someone who has a lot of questions about this, and I'm not even sure what I think about aspects of this, I often feel insecure just about having a one-on-one conversation with someone who is either strongly pro-life or pro-choice. And so I just am really grateful that you guys have been willing to sit and talk with each other, as well as me, mostly as a bystander, about all of this. So thank you.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
We're now going to take a quick break, and we will be back to talk about Medicare for All.
Over the last 25 years, the world has witnessed incredible progress, from dial-up modems to 5G connectivity, from massive PC towers to AI-enabled microchips. Innovators are rethinking possibilities every day. Through it all, Invesco's QQQ ETF has provided investors access to the world of innovation. Be a part of the next 25 years of new ideas by supporting the fund that gives you access to innovative companies. Invesco QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. There are risks when investing in ETFs, including possible loss of money. ETFs risks are similar to those of stocks. Investments in the tech sector are subject to greater risk and more volatility than more diversified investments. Before investing, carefully read and consider fund investment objectives, risks, charges, expenses, and more in prospectus at Invesco.com. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
This is A.O. Scott. I'm a critic at the New York Times. What I do and what the other critics here do is part of the same project that all of the journalists at the New York Times work on every day, to give you clarity and perspective, and above all, a deeper understanding of the world. When you subscribe to the New York Times, it's not just here are the headlines, but here's the way everything fits together. If you'd like to subscribe, please go to nytimes.com/subscribe.
Kamala Harris, the Democratic senator and presidential candidate, recently did something surprising. She called for the boldest version of Medicare for All, the version in which all private insurance would go away. But her remarks still sparked a debate, both between the political left and right and among progressives.
I believe the solution, and I'm actually feel very strongly about this, is that we need to have Medicare for All. That's just the bottom line.
Advocates for her version of Medicare for All pointed to a Kaiser Family Foundation poll showing that most Americans support Medicare for All. Skeptics, and I'm one of them, noted that the support plummeted when people heard they couldn't have private insurance under Medicare for All. Because this show is called The Argument, we wanted to air both sides of this issue, and so we invited Diane Archer to join us. She was the founder of the Medicare Right Center and is the president of JustCareUSA.org. Michelle stepped out of the studio for this segment, and she'll be back later. So welcome, Diane. Thank you for joining us.
Nice to be here, David.
So can you make the case for us for the boldest version of Medicare for All, in which we replace our rickety system of private insurance with single-payer health care, in which everyone gets their health insurance from the government?
I'm actually going to make the case for the only version of Medicare for All. There's a lot of other versions of Medicare for More, Medicare for Many, but let me first define Medicare for All. Medicare for All is federally administered health insurance that allows people to see doctors, almost all doctors, and use most hospitals anywhere in the country. Today, there are 60 million people eligible for Medicare, people over 65, and people with disabilities. What Medicare for All does is it improves on Medicare. It takes away the premiums, the deductibles, and the coinsurance. And it improves on benefits, adding in vision, hearing, dental, and home and community-based care. And then it expands that coverage to everyone in the country.
So I think the heart of the debate here is there are a lot of people, I was about to say a lot of progressives, but it's actually a lot of people across the political spectrum, including conservatives, who are in favor of expanded government health insurance. I'm in favor of that, right? But once we get to this idea that Senator Harris spelled out, where I appreciated her honesty. She says, I'm in favor of getting rid of private health insurance. To me, that's a political pipe dream. We're just never going to get it. This isn't just about polls. We saw Bill Clinton's healthcare plan fail because people thought they were going to lose their health care. We saw that was the main attack on Obama's health care reform. And so this idea that somehow we can improve the health insurance system by taking away people's health insurance, it may be true in some sort of political laboratory, but it's never going to happen. And so to me, it's kind of an unforced error for Democrats to be talking about it.
Actually, I think it's the only thing they should be talking about, because what we have today is a system that's dysfunctional. The costs are out of control. They're unsustainable. And people aren't able to get the care they need. What we know now from two big research projects about how Medicare for All would work from a financial perspective is that people would be paying less for their health care. About 80% of Americans would be paying less for their health care than they're paying today. And national health spending would go down, by conservative estimates, by $2 trillion over 10 years, by other estimates, as much as $5 trillion over 10 years. So we can afford it. It makes sense. It's the right way to go. Any compromise position doesn't allow us to drive down the costs and to ensure people access to care.
So I actually agree with a lot of the substance of what you're laying out, but I almost think that the substance isn't the question here. I cannot fathom a world in which we persuade huge numbers of Americans that they do not have a right to private insurance. And so what I want is a better healthcare system, and I worry that the push for mandatory Medicare for All, or as you call it, the only Medicare for All, is just a route to failure where we don't actually get to keep improving our health system and trying to make people's lives better. So how do you think, why am I being too cynical? How does the political case work for persuading people that it's okay that they don't have the right to buy private health insurance?
Well, let me step back a second, because you mentioned earlier the recent Kaiser survey showing that 56% of the public supported Medicare for All. What you didn't mention is that 67% of the public support Medicare for All when they're told that it eliminates premiums, deductibles, and coinsurance. And 71% of the public support Medicare for All when they're told that it guarantees health care as a human right. No one asked people whether they supported Medicare for All if it did away with all cost sharing, guaranteed health care as a human right, and gave them access to most doctors and hospitals throughout the country. My bet is that if you ask them that, you would have even higher numbers in the 80 to 90% range. So what they really want, as I see it, is they want the ability to go to the doctor without worry about the cost. And that's what Medicare for All gives them.
I mean, it seems like the sales pitch being offered here is basically that Medicare for All will be wonderful because it will cost much, much less than our current system and deliver much, much more, right? And I think it's to most people. Right?
It will cost a little less.
A little less. Okay, so
it will give everyone coverage at less cost.
So I'm clearly not running for office.
So I'm curious. That was a very admirable concession.
I agree.
But one of the things that we see in other countries, Canada and Europe, that have systems comparable to this, is that they do succeed in driving down costs in certain ways relative to the U.S. But they do it in part because of dramatic cultural differences in people's expectations for what the system will cover. If you look at Canada, for instance, you have sort of an assumption that there are certain, you know, expensive procedures that maybe you're going to have to go to the U.S. to get. If you look at how much doctors are paid, how much hospitals make in European countries, there's a big difference between the U.S. and here. The U.S. has a culture of consumerist entitlement that applies to what patients expect, what doctors expect to make, what hospitals expect to make, and so on. And I have a certain skepticism that if you layer on top of this culture of medical entitlement a system where the sales pitch is this will finally pay for all the things that you find too expensive right now, that you're actually going to be able to drive down costs.
A couple of points. First of all, we do have an almost 55-year track record with Medicare, bringing down costs and giving people the care they need. And what we also know is we have a Koch Brothers funded study out of the Mercatus Center very conservative.
Some of my best friends at the Mercatus
Center. There you go. And they're taking into consideration the fact that people will be using the system more. So what we know is that other wealthy countries have universal health care, and they also have far better health outcomes overall than we do at half the cost.
And the main reason is that we would eliminate wasteful care, or it's that we would reduce the profits of drug companies and the salaries of doctors? And
good question. So we reduce the cost a few ways. One way is we get rid of a lot of the administrative waste in the system, and some have estimated that to be about $500 billion a year. And then we have the federal government negotiating on behalf of all 330 million of us, and that will bring some fairness and rationality to the prices that we're paying for health care today. So those two together will save a lot of money to the system. Obviously, also getting commercial health insurers out of the mix will take their profits out of the system and bring down costs further.
It seems to me that the Democrats can only really have one or two priorities. And you can make an existential case. I'm appealing to you here, David, that their top priority should be climate change. And I think you can make a financial case that their top priority should be just a little more redistribution directly of cash, which could be spent on medical bills or other things. And after the Obamacare experience, both of those, were I a liberal, would seem more attractive than another big healthcare push right now. So what do either of you make of that argument?
I share that. Meaning, to me, the idea that the next time there's a Democratic Congress and president, which could be 2021 or could be later than that, the idea that they are going to go after the same issue that Bill Clinton went after and failed and Barack Obama went after and I think made a lot of progress, not enough, but a lot of progress, to me would be a mistake. And I would much rather see continued push around progress on healthcare. But if the Democrats made Medicare for All their number one push and failed to make progress on climate, on democracy rights, or on inequality, I would think it would be really, really unfortunate.
It would be unfortunate. We have to win. But we know that the top or one of the top policy issues that among Americans is healthcare costs. That is what everybody is talking about. And Ross, I know I've read you make the point that more healthcare doesn't necessarily deliver better health. But last week I spoke to a nurse with ulcerative colitis and her daughter has gastritis. She works full time, family of five. Her husband works full time. Their income is $80,000 a year. And she told me she had to back burner treatment for her ulcerative colitis because her daughter's gastritis had to come first. She has maxed out her credit card debt. Her ulcerative colitis needs to be treated, and she's going to get worse, and the system's going to spend more ultimately taking care of her because she isn't treating it now and she can't. And that's a choice we shouldn't be making. That's a choice we shouldn't be forcing anybody to make in this country. We're the wealthiest country in the world. There is a way to give everybody affordable health care at lower cost, or even if you want to say at about the same cost. Why wouldn't we do it?
But what's wrong? So can I just ask, what does that woman you're talking about have health insurance?
Yes, she has health insurance. She has health insurance, good health insurance, but there's a $3,000 deductible and a 30% coinsurance payment to see the doctors and to use the hospital.
Again, putting on, let's say, my Sherrod Brown hat, right? Maybe you would say, look, we're going to have a policy that, you know, puts that woman in the range for a larger earned income tax credit or, depending on how old her daughter is, a larger child tax credit. And she has $5,000 or $10,000 more in disposable income. And in that situation, she can pay the $3,000 copay. But another person who's, you know, has a different financial difficulty that doesn't flow from healthcare costs will also benefit. And someone who might, you know, end up spending money on unnecessary care won't, right? I mean, I guess what's the case for that woman's costs as opposed to, you know, the guy who lost his job and can't pay for his kid's daycare or something?
I think the thing about health insurance is that it's there to protect you when you're healthy and when you're sick. And nobody knows when they're going to need expensive health care, right? Tomorrow, I could be in a car accident. I could be diagnosed with cancer. And those bills are a lot more than $5,000 or $10,000. When you go to the hospital these days, it's more like $20,000, $40,000, $60,000, $100,000. So an earned income tax credit is not going to carry you through.
I agree.
The beauty, the elegance of Medicare is that it pools risk, right? It brings everybody together, and then it broadly distributes costs across everybody. So if you're healthy, it's not spending money. But if you're sick, you're not burdened with additional costs as you are in our commercial healthcare system.
But part of what's going to happen under your system, presumably, is that we'll have this same conversation, you know, 10 years on in the second Bernie Sanders second term, right, when this is passed into law. And there will be some cancer treatments that your system, if it really is going to drive down costs, isn't going to pay for. You're going to have some people who are in difficult situations with experimental treatments. And, you know, under any reasonable Medicare for All system, European or Canadian, part of the way it saves money is by saying we're not going to pay for those things. And my guess is that if you have a system like that where everybody is paying in much more than they do now in taxes to get this system, and there's this expectation, this promise of care, that there's going to be constant political pressure against the Medicare bureaucracy saying, you have to pay for this, you have to pay for that, you have to pay for that, which will be stronger than against the insurance companies right now. Do you think Medicare for All will be able to say no effectively?
I think
to
today
treatments?
We're saying no every day to thousands of people, tens of thousands of people who need these treatments all the time. That's the MO. People can't get the treatments they need here. Yes, obviously we can't pay for everything that everyone needs at astronomical costs. But again, Medicare for All is going to do one thing that's really important, which is to set fair prices for services. Right now, prices are really kind of insane. They are insane, yes. They're crazy.
Let's end here. So it's 2021, and the Democrats actually have taken both the House and the Senate, as well as the presidency. You obviously know what the other side is going to say, right? You're restricting choice. You're taking away people's insurance. We saw it with Clinton. We saw a little bit of it with Obama. So can you give us a sense, how is it that the Medicare for All side wins this time? What's the case they make?
Okay. So it's education. So let's start with taking away insurance. I would say this. If people don't like losing their insurance, then they should embrace Medicare for All. Here's why. Every year, we're often forced to lose our insurance when our employer changes insurers. If we lose our job, if we switch jobs, if our insurance decides to change the terms and change doctors. So we are effectively all losing our insurance all the time. With Medicare for All, you get to pick your doctors that you want to see, use the hospitals you want to use, and it's guaranteed health care for the rest of your life. You have that continuity of care. So people don't yet understand that, but I think once they do, they will embrace it. I think that's what we need to do. We need to educate people that they're going to pay less, they're going to get more, and they're going to be able to see the doctors they want to see when they need to without insurance companies coming between them and the needs that they have.
Well, we really appreciate your coming on because we know we have a lot of listeners who share your view, and so we wanted to make sure we gave a full airing to the pro-Medicare for All side. And I remain skeptical that it's going to happen, but I also think your side is winning. I think you guys have moved this debate a long way in a relatively short time. So when Medicare for All actually happens, we hope you'll come back and celebrate.
I would love to.
Thanks
so much.
Michelle is back with us in the studio now, and it is time for our weekly recommendation, something to take your mind off of contemporary politics. Ross, this week is your turn.
I mean, I don't think this is going to count because I'm going to bring it back to contemporary politics, but I've been reading the new doorstop of an English language biography of Charles de Gaulle, by Julian Jackson.
I just need to say that Ross is younger than me.
Listen, this is a good book. I'm recommending it without having finished it yet, and I read big books slowly, even though I'm very, very young. But what's interesting about de Gaulle is that ultimately his whole project was to take this country, France, that had become so polarized between Catholics and secularists, liberals and conservatives, monarchists and socialists and so on, and try to sort of pull back together some kind of common sense of national identity that would enable the nation to, you know, sort of revive itself in the aftermath of Vichy and World War II. And reading it, it's hard not to see some resonances to contemporary American politics. Like, there is a sense in which we are, you know, without, fortunately, the guillotines, the Paris communes, and so on, there is a sense in which we resemble the sort of hyper-polarized late 9th and early 20th century French society. And there is a sense in which de Gaulle's project of, like, figuring out how you could make Catholic monarchists and the heirs of the French Revolution sort of have some sense of their country's common history that would bind them together is sort of our project, too. And, of course, de Gaulle did this, you know, in the aftermath of a Nazi conquest, which hopefully is not going to be the situation in which we find ourselves in the future. Anyway, it seems relevant.
Oh, wait. Now I feel bad for making fun of you because now it sounds interesting.
It is. It's interesting. I mean, de Gaulle, the book has a sort of great dry tone. Like, de Gaulle gets captured in World War I and he keeps escaping from German prison camps. And the author is basically like, he could never get very far because, you know, he was like 6'5", right? And so he just stands out in any escape he attempts.
So again, what's the title and author?
It's just de Gaulle, and it's Julian Jackson.
Excellent. Thank you, Ross. That's our show for this week. Thank you, as always, for listening. If you have thoughts, ideas for segments, criticisms, leave us a voicemail at 347-915-4324, and we may play you on the air. You can also email us with your thoughts at argument@nytimes.com. If you like what you hear, we hope you will leave a rating or review in Apple Podcasts. This week's show was produced by Alex Laughlin for Transmitter Media and edited by Lacey Roberts. Our executive producer is Greta Cohn. We had help from Tyson Evans, Phoebe Lett, and Ian Prasad Philbrick. Our theme was composed by Allison Leighton Brown. See you next week.
Let's start with Michelle saying, I'm Michelle Goldberg.
I'm Michelle Goldberg. Wait, sorry, can I do it a little?
Michelle imitating Alex imitating Michelle is great.
Okay, sorry.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.